Hello, and welcome to Words on Film, the spoken word podcast dedicated to moving pictures. I'm Dan Burke, your host and movie critic, and I'm here to tell you exactly what I think of some of the latest movies out right now. And of course, it is not any new news that many of us are socially distancing. And if we're not, we should be. For that reason, the movie theaters aren't open and a lot of people aren't going out to see films. And not that I want that to change anytime soon. Of course I want it to change, but I want to be safe when it changes. And it will happen eventually, hopefully in about a month or two. But of course, I'm not exactly that much in tune with the news, so I can't exactly say when that's going to happen, but I'm just keeping up hope that it will. But, of course, many of us are watching films from the comfort of our own homes, which I'm not against. I'm one of those people who prefers to go to the movies as opposed to watch it on streaming at home. But even though I prefer going to the movies, I definitely watch plenty of movies via streaming from home. Although nowadays it's actually a lot of TV shows. And the reason I don't have a ton of films to review for this show is because I was so hooked on two particular series on Netflix. The first was Tiger King, which I watched in 2 days. It was that addicting, and I loved it. And the other one was the third season of Ozark. And both of these shows happen to be the number one and number two most watched Netflix selections, respectively, and for very good reason. They are very addicting. But this is Words on Film, not Words on TV shows. Although I might make an exception with miniseries a little while later, but I will just move on to the actual films that I've seen. And I'm going to start off with actually another Netflix original that is, in fact, a documentary. This one is called Crip Camp. Does this have to do with the Crip as in the gang? No, it doesn't. It actually has to do with the other known Crip, which is the politically incorrect way of talking about people who are physically and in some cases mentally handicapped, i.e. cripples. Not that I condone that, but that is the name of the documentary. So the documentary is directed by James Lebrecht and Nicole Noonham. James Lebrecht actually has a vast career in films, but this is actually his directorial debut. He has been on the set of various movies in the sound department. For instance, he worked on the sound department for Dragon, the Bruce Lee story from 1993. I'm very sorry to say Battlefield Earth from the year 2000. And while that's an embarrassing black mark on the repertoire of John Travolta, I don't think the sound department got any grief for that. After all, James Lebrecht still has a career. So anyway, that's James Lebrecht's directorial, or rather his movie effort so far. Nicole Noonan has actually, she has been producing several films, including documentaries like The Rape of Europa and Sentenced Home, amongst others. She has directed other documentary features before, the aforementioned documentaries that I mentioned, as well as The Revolutionary Optimist from 2013, which I haven't seen, but her repertoire is new to me because this is the first film I've seen on which she worked. So, what is Crip Camp about? It is about a camp for physically handicapped and in some case mentally handicapped children, which operated down the road from Woodstock, that is where Woodstock originally happened in upstate New York. And according to the tagline, or at least the plot synopsis that I'm reading here, a revolution blossomed at a ramshackle summer camp for teenagers with disabilities, transforming their lives and igniting a landmark movement. So Crip Camp actually has the benefit of having a lot of really rich archive footage. And who knows who actually shot this footage. I didn't watch the credits to see exactly who did, but the whoever shot this back in the early to mid 70s must have known that this footage was eventually going to make it into a documentary. Either that, or directors James LeBrecht and Nicole Noonan got really lucky finding this footage. It would have been actually kind of nice to know where they found this footage. And again, this is my issue with the found footage craze, which has since died out, thankfully, and not so much documentaries, but we keep seeing these, or we kept seeing these found footage movies, which were entirely fictional. But one thing I would have liked to have seen in those films was somebody actually finding the footage. It would have been interesting to see, you know, where they found it, why they screened it for themselves, and so on and so forth. But for now, I mean, Crypt Camp got really lucky with this archive footage. It's amazing what they did with it. And the vast majority of people who were interviewed for this documentary were people who were residing at the camp, not the people who are running the camp. And I think that's where the documentary is a little bit weak, because here you have this camp in this remote part of upstate New York, but you don't know, as you're watching the film, who runs it, why they decided to open it up. All of this would have been very good things to know. And if the people who ran the camp were deceased, then that's one thing. But it doesn't even look like they're even mentioned. I think probably about one or two counselors are interviewed here, but the vast majority of interviewees are people who resided at the camp. That is, people who weren't counselors, but they were actually campers. And while it was great to hear some of their stories, even from some of the people whose articulation isn't exactly clear, it still would have been great to have known exactly why the camp was opened, who was running it, what they were like, what their motivation for opening the camp was. But in absence of that, they actually have a lot of really good footage and interviews, particularly by one particular camper with polio. And she, of course, is physically handicapped, but is of sound mind. And actually showing her as well as other physically handicapped people, some of whom resided at this so-called Crip camp. And again, I cringe whenever I say that term, but it is the name of the movie. But it was great to actually see a lot of articulate interviews and footage of some of these people staging protests for equal rights for those who were physically handicapped. And this is at the tail end. This is in the early to mid 70s. So it's at the tail end of the civil rights movement. But it's about an oppressed group of people about whom you almost never read in history books. And if you do, there's usually one paragraph dedicated to them. So I give this movie complete props for elaborating upon their stories and their struggles and the protests, including some of the sit-in protests they had to endure in order to get the rights that to which they were entitled. That's a great part of this documentary. But again, I really wanted a little bit more of the backstory. And it seemed like for a documentary that's called Crip Camp, you would think that there is a little bit more emphasis on the camp itself. And for a documentary that is only about 1 hour, 46 minutes long, I shouldn't say only, because that's about the average length for a documentary, but for a documentary that long, they only really dedicate about 20 minutes to the camp itself. And I don't particularly think that was the best course of action in this case. And also, they talk quite a bit about the camp in the very beginning of the film, and then they go on to other topics, related topics, mind you, and the fact that many of these physically handicapped people met at this camp. But they only tack on to the very end that the camp closed in 1977. But they don't get into why. I mean, of course, when you see the footage, you can tell that this is not a particularly ostentatious camp and is probably has a budget that's stretched to its limit. And you can tell that, you can extrapolate that from the archive footage very well. But I really needed someone to articulate why the camp was open in the first place, why it shut down, and if it had such a revolutionary effect on the people who attended the camp, why did they close it? And also, are there other camps like that around the country? There must be by this point, because a lot of people are more aware about physically handicapped people. And I think a lot of people nowadays, thanks in large part to the peaceful protests that these people made in the mid to late 70s, can really appreciate their struggles if they can't entirely sympathize with them. And Crip Camp also, I should mention, two of the well-known producers of this documentary are, and I'm not making this up, Barack and Michelle Obama, who also were behind the production company that made the Academy Award-winning American Factory from last year, which was one of my favorite films, probably my favorite documentary of last year. And I saw some great documentaries last year. Crip Camp is not quite as good as American Factory, but it's still a good documentary, and it's one I recommend by giving my rating of a checkout. The interviews in this movie were excellent. The archive footage, probably what they had, which might not have been a huge amount, still served this documentary really well. But what I really wanted to know was the story behind the camp. And maybe if they release a documentary about the making of this documentary, which I think Netflix might do later, they might actually answer that question. Having a great time discussing movies. And now, actually, I'm going to discuss a movie which is out on DVD, but man, I had to see this film in theaters. And part of me, after seeing this film, will never be back. Part of me is just gone forever. That film, for those of you who have tuned into my show when I was talking about the Razzies, as you might imagine, is Cats. Now, I am somebody who can appreciate a good movie musical. I have several movies that I love that are musicals, and not just the Disney films. I think probably my favorite musical of all time is actually Cabaret, which you might not expect from a guy like me, but Cabaret is an amazing film, deserved to win most of the Oscars that it did, but there are so many problems with Cats, I don't exactly know where to start here. I guess I can start with the horrific CGI. So, but first, let me give a little bit of backstory here. Cats is based on, is a movie musical that was written and composed by Andrew Lloyd Webber, and it's based on a poetry collection by T.S. Eliot called Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. Now, what's interesting is that the book was not quite as popular as other books that T.S. Eliot wrote, but it was popular enough that Walt Disney himself actually asked T.S. Eliot personally if he could buy the movie rights to the book to make an animated film out of it, and T.S. Eliot turned him down. Yeah, you don't hear about many people who turned Walt Disney himself down for a movie. If Walt Disney likes your book, I guess, you know, Most other people, except for P.L. Travers, who wrote Mary Poppins, said yes without even really thinking about it. And P.L. Travers is another story for another time. But the point is, T.S. Eliot was so protective of this poetry collection that not even Walt Disney could get the movie rights to it. But eventually T.S. Eliot passed away, and Andrew Lloyd Webber, the Broadway composer, actually approached T.S. Eliot's widow to make Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats into a Broadway musical, and with some reluctance, she approved. But Andrew Lloyd Webber took this musical, debuted it on the London stage in 1981, and it eventually made its way to Broadway in the mid-80s, and it goes without saying that Cats was a huge hit on the Broadway stage. However, you would think that something that was big on the Broadway stage would instantly get movie rights sold and would make its way onto the big screen. Well, it wasn't quite that simple. Cats was in development hell for literally 25 years, and there was even one point where Steven Spielberg and David Geffen had gotten the movie rights for themselves, and they were actually going to make an animated movie out of Cats. And if you go online and do a Google search, you will find actually the original concept art for the animated version of Cats. It would have looked amazing, but unfortunately, Steven Spielberg's Amblin Entertainment, Animation, which was behind such movies as Who Framed Roger Rabbit, An American Tale, its sequel, An American Tale, Fievel Goes West, and a few other animated films, eventually folded after several bombs. So, Steven Spielberg is not exactly bulletproof when it comes to great ideas for movies. But eventually, somebody else got the movie rights for Cats, and they got Tom Hooper, who is an Academy Award-winning director who directed 2010's The King's Speech and the long-awaited musical adaptation of Les Miserables, which won several Academy Awards, including Best Supporting Actress for Anne Hathaway. And The King's Speech won Best Picture. Les Mis was nominated for Best Picture. It didn't win, and some people had issues with that musical adaptation, but it was successful enough for Tom Hooper to direct this version of Cats. And Tom Hooper is a competent director, so you can already tell what rating I'm going to give Cats. What went wrong? Well, as I said earlier, without beating into the ground too much, the CGI in this film is horrific. Oh my God, it looks half-baked. And you don't even have to look that closely to see that these cat-human hybrids have human hands to know what's wrong with the CGI in this film. Let me just put it this way. These humanoid cats, and it's not really particularly well established if they're supposed to be cats in a human world. I guess it wasn't particularly well established in the Broadway musical either, but then again, I haven't seen the Broadway musical, so I don't know. But you can't tell if they're supposed to be regular cats who just speak amongst themselves in their own language, if they're supposed to be anthropomorphic, i.e., you know, wearing clothes and acting like human beings in a world where there are no humans, or I don't have a third option. It's just absolutely freaky to look at these people, these cat hybrids. And the CGI is so bad that when actors move their heads, their faces are actually delayed sometimes in moving alongside with them. It takes a fraction of a second, but it's a fraction of a second way too long. Another problem I have with this movie is it does not have a plot. Basically, these cats, who are a tribe of cats known as the Jellicle Cats, I don't know what Jellicle means, even though I heard that word about 15 times in this musical. Anyway, these Jellicle Cats have this talent show, I think, once a year to decide which one will, and I quote, ascend to the Heaviside layer and come back to a new Jellicle life, end quote. Now, I don't know what the Heaviside layer is, but watching this film, it sounds like death. It sounds like if you win a talent show, you are sentenced to die. And it just doesn't make any sense to me. Why would cats do that? Why would cats participate in something where they're basically going to be executed? And I'm not saying that there's a guy with an axe just waiting to chop off the head of the cat who wins this talent show within this musical, but it really rubs me the wrong way. What else is wrong with cats? Pick a number. Oh my gosh. Related to the CGI effects, there are things in this musical that I would pay somebody to have me unsee. But the problem with that is, because I am very curious about movies, I would have that memory erased. I would say, I really want to see the musical adaptation of Cats. I don't care how it is. I want to see it for myself. I'd see it again. I'd be horrified. I'd go to this person, have them erase my memory. I'd pay again. And I would just be wasting money, getting my memories erased, and wanting to see this film again. So basically, the most horrific part of this movie is when Rebel Wilson appears as this cat by the name of Jenny Anydots. And normally I find Rebel Wilson funny, but my God, there are scenes in this movie where she actually enslaves mice to sing for her. And she pulls a curtain back and there are these mice with children's faces who are singing for her. You have to see it to know how creepy this is. But it doesn't stop there. There is another scene where inexplicably, Jenny Anydots, again, Rebel Wilson's character, has this army of cockroaches that tap dance for her. Again, it does not sound creepy, but first of all, they have human faces. And secondly, periodically, Jenny Anydots, for no apparent reason, picks the cockroaches up and eats them. And you hear the crunch. And it was a good thing I was not eating anything when I was watching this film, because I would have instantly spit it out. It's horrific. I mean, when I was watching this segment with the cockroaches, I was, for a moment, reminded of the movie Joe's Apartment, which was also about talking and singing cockroaches. Not with human faces, by the way, but still. But then when I saw Rebel Wilson eat these humanoid cockroaches, I was instantly horrified. Is there anything good about the movie Cats? There are some good things. For instance, the dancing is good. The singing is very good, especially when Jennifer Hudson comes in and sings Memories. And Jennifer Hudson is an amazing singer. There is no doubt about that. She's also an amazing actress. But her singing and her acting credibility, even from an Academy Award winner like her, is undermined by the fact that, first of all, as I said, the CGI on her is horrific. And secondly, the camera closes in on her face. So, and she spends most of the movie crying, but there is a drip of snot that's coming out of her nose that doesn't seem to go away. And she wears a jacket. Again, there's that ambiguity about whether these cats are anthropomorphic or not. And I just wanted to say to Jennifer Hudson's character, you have a jacket. I know it's disgusting, but you're a homeless cat. Blow your nose. But even more so than that, what I wanted to do, more than advise these characters what to do, is just take a big bucket of water and throw them at the cats. All of them. It didn't matter whether they were antagonists or protagonists. They were just disgusting to watch. I absolutely hated just seeing this musical and these awful attempts, even by Rebel Wilson and James Corden, of humor that they displayed, the fact that there was no plot, the fact that the songs were just basically exposition of each and every character, and once many of these songs about these cats, you know, where they're singing about themselves was over, you usually never saw the cats again. Now, I think Cats worked on a stage because it's more of an interactive experience on a stage. The stage musical, I think for a lot of people, and it wouldn't have been this way if Cats wasn't a hit, but it didn't need to have a plot. It was driven by character and also by live interactions with these characters. As long as the actors could sing and dance and were believable enough as Cats, I don't think people who saw this movie on Broadway or the people who became huge fans of Cats really minded. But man, this movie just flat out did not work on screen. And I do think that the bad CGI had a lot to do with that. I think that either the Cats should have been in real costumes like on Broadway, or it should have been animated. But meeting them in the middle and having real people in CGI animated costumes was a hot mess. Other people have reviewed Cats. They have thrown out all sorts of cat puns, maybe even more cat puns than in the movie Cats. But the point is, this movie is just flat out terrible. It goes without saying, it is a flunk out. And unquestionably, the worst movie of 2019, and it might have been the worst movie of the decade as well. It might have been. I probably would have put one of the 50 Shades of Grey movies as one of the worst films of the decade, but I don't know. I'd really have to do my research. But considering I started this show in 2014, there are 4 years of movies that I've missed before doing the show. Did I go out to movies before 2014, before doing the show? Absolutely. Did I go out to as many films? No, I didn't. And I certainly had the luxury of skipping movies I thought were bad. But man, I think I've spoken enough about how terrible a movie Cats is. I will move on. You're listening to the show Words on Film, which is the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures, and I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. So there are some other films that have been released on DVD, Blu-ray, and in some cases 4K. Actually, I could get into the movies that were released this past Tuesday, April 7th, in the year of our Lord 2020, but I've discussed a lot of those last week, like Doolittle starring Robert Downey Jr. and Little Women directed by Greta Gerwig and starring Saoirse Ronan, Emma Watson, and Florence Pugh, amongst other people. But I pretty much discussed that on last week's episode. However, I will say that there are only a select few movies that are on 4K or available for 4K. And truth be told, I actually don't know anybody who has a 4K player or has an HD TV that can accommodate 4K. Obviously, they are out there. I just don't know them personally. But I would say good news and bad news on the 4K front. The good news is that all 9 Star Wars movies and Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, which is not one of the 9 movies in the Star Wars canon, it's more like a spinoff, are available on 4K. The bad news, especially for Star Wars fans, is that George Lucas, who obviously signed on to have these movies get released on 4K, is still not releasing the original 3 Star Wars movies, Star Wars A New Hope, aka the original one, The Empire Strikes Back, or Return of the Jedi, as they were originally released in the 70s and the 80s. Now, just a brief history of the Star Wars trilogy, and this is really infuriating. People were really excited back in 1997 when George Lucas re-released Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi back in the theaters by popular demand. The caveat and the quid pro quo about that was that those three movies were released with additional CGI footage added to them. Now, at the time, nobody, including me, really had a problem with these extra scenes. It was actually kind of cool to see, for instance, an extra Jabba the Hutt scene that was not in the original A New Hope. As a matter of fact, Jabba the Hutt was not in the original Star Wars film. So to see that extra film was real. To see that extra footage that was filmed in the 70s, actually with another character in the film, but was never released, was really exciting. But ultimately, that novelty wore off when people realized that George Lucas was not going to release the three films as they were originally made in the 70s and 80s. And when he eventually released those three films on DVD and Blu-ray, they were still the ones with additional footage, which he originally, which he intentionally doctored. And a lot of people have problems with that. I mean, even something as little as Han shooting first, people have a problem with that. It just destroys the authenticity of the original film. Now, I of course love a vast majority of the Star Wars films. But I'm not one of those people who has watched the original Star Wars, for instance, so many times that I know what number pod Darth Vader walks through 15 minutes into the film. And people are very particular about details like that. But I will say this. I am a stickler, like many hardcore Star Wars fans, of authenticity. And I think it is really puzzling why George Lucas does not listen to his fans. Fans young and old have been petitioning him and saying, screaming out basically, please release the three original Star Wars films as they were originally released in theaters. And George Lucas has silently refused to do so. I don't know exactly why. I don't know why George Lucas would do this to his fans. Even famous fans, like the South Park guys, have made fun of George Lucas for doing this. I don't really have an answer, but if you want to see the nine Star Wars films and Rogue One and maybe even Solo, the other spinoff of the Star Wars films, in high, high definition, they are available on 4K now. I just want to let you guys know that you are listening to Words on Film. And Words on Film is the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. And I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. And I am so glad you could join me to discuss my favorite topic, which is movies. So as you could probably tell from my recent rant about Star Wars being released on 4K, which is both a blessing and a curse, but really a curse because of George Lucas's being stubborn like a mule, I have not actually seen many new films this week. I will more than make it up to you people who are listening on next week's show. But I will tell you, actually, some of the films that are being released on Blu-ray and DVD, and no 4K this week, this coming Tuesday, which is April 14th, 2020. One of the films that's being released on DVD and Blu-ray is one called Just Mercy, which was released nationwide this past January. I think it got an early release, or rather a early limited release in December, but an early limited release opens it up in New York and LA. When you're living in a smaller city like Nashville, like I do, or even if my previous city, my fair city of Boston, you don't get the benefit of seeing these movies early, but you do have the benefit of seeing it now since it's been released on DVD and Blu-ray. So, Just Mercy is a movie about world-renowned civil rights defense attorney Brian Stevenson, played in this movie by Michael B. Jordan, who works to free a wrongly condemned death row prisoner, who is played in this movie by Jamie Foxx. Is this person successful? Well, I don't know for sure, particularly because I don't know. I haven't seen this film, and I don't know the story behind it. I do know that it is based on a true story, and it's gotten very good reviews. It didn't get any Academy Award or Golden Globe nominations. I think it was a little too late for this film, but it is out on DVD and Blu-ray right now, so if you want to check it out, you certainly have that opportunity. And also, since a lot of places that sell DVDs and Blu-rays are closed right now, I would say your only option is Amazon, but there are other places online that sell DVDs and Blu-rays if you are a little worried about Amazon taking over the world, in which case I don't exactly blame you. But another film that's coming out on DVD and Blu-ray is one called Underwater. This was a film, I think it might even be one of the, it's actually probably not one of the first films to be released in January of 2020, or rather 2020, that's released on DVD and Blu-ray, but the movie is called Underwater, and this is a movie that kind of came and went. It was a bomb at the box office. It stars Kristen Stewart, Vincent Cassell, and T.J. Miller, and it is a film that, at least from the poster and what I know about it, is very reminiscent of Alien. But it's about a crew of oceanic researchers working for a deep-sea drilling company who are trying to get to safety after a mysterious earthquake devastates their deepwater research and drilling facility located at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. For those of you who don't remember your fifth grade science, the Mariana Trench is the deepest known trench on Earth. So this obviously promises an intense ride, but with Kristen Stewart in the lead, I don't exactly know. Because Kristen Stewart is still famous, of course. She's still getting a lot of high-profile leading roles, and she seems to be shaking off the stigma of being in the Twilight films. Very much like Robert Pattinson, but unlike Robert Pattinson, I don't think that Kristen Stewart has completely shaken that stigma off. Also, while I could go one way or the other with Twilight films, I can't exactly tell you that they're the worst of the decade. I presume they are, but I can't tell you that for sure because I haven't seen any of them. I haven't seen, you know, the first Twilight movie or the two based on the last book, because Hollywood just does not have the guts to release a 4-hour film despite having a mass following. And trust me when I say that people who are huge fans of Twilight, I'm sure they grew up and move on right now, but back in 2012 or 2013, they would have paid anything to get into a 4-hour Twilight film. Would I have? No, definitely not, because I certainly have my standards. But regardless, the other films in which I've seen Kristen Stewart, she's been pretty good, like in Still Alice. But then there are other films, like the one she was in with Jesse Eisenberg that was directed by Woody Allen. And I can't remember the name of the film, but there are some other times where Kristen Stewart looks like she just doesn't really care about being in the film, and her performance definitely shows it. And if I'm wrong, if she really loves to be in the film, then why is she acting jaded? So I don't know if this is the case with Kristen Stewart in this film, because I haven't seen it. But I'm letting you know that it is out on DVD and Blu-ray, and I'm just letting you guys know what my particular biases are, because, of course, this is a show that is based solely on my opinion. So the other two DVD releases, actually, except for one, are our TV releases. There's the final season of Criminal Minds that's out on DVD, if you're interested. And there's also The Righteous Gemstones, which is an HBO series, which I've seen previews of. And the TV show actually stars a really good roster of actors, including Danny McBride, John Goodman, Adam Devine, and others. But I can't comment on that, A, because I haven't seen the show, and B, because this is words on film, not words on TV shows. And a lot of people ask me, actually, why is it that I don't review TV shows on here? And the reason is, it takes a maximum 3.5 hours to watch a movie. But even if I really, really love a TV series, like I was gushing earlier about Ozark, which is an amazing show, it takes a really long time to watch a TV series, especially one that I hate. I just don't have that particular amount of time to dedicate to TV shows. And also there's the issue that inevitably there are going to be some TV episodes that are better than others, and you kind of know which ones there are. And even really great shows like The Sopranos and Breaking Bad had at least one episode that was draggy or flawed. And why rip on one particular episode of a TV show when, especially with these continuous series that are marking the second golden age of television right now, more than make up for one of those weak episodes? I just can't really bring myself to do that, and I don't really have that set mind to do it. So the only other film that I can see that's being released on DVD and Blu-ray and Prime Video, if you wish, is one called Final Kill. And this is one that I think is released directly to video, i.e. it's either released directly to DVD and or streaming. And this is a movie, it's an action film, directed and written by Justin Lee, about an aging protection specialist who takes on one last job before retirement, protecting a couple who stole $8 million from a ruthless crime family. The movie stars Ed Moroney, Randy Couture, and Danny Trejo. Judging from the fact that Randy Couture is in it, it definitely suggests that this is a lower-budget action film. Not necessarily to say that it's bad, but Ed Moroney, and I'm not sure if his last name is pronounced Moroney or Marone, but I'm going to pronounce Moroney because that might be his name, is an actor who has been in a number of movies and TV shows, including Hellblazers, The Fugitive Chronicles from 2010, and White Collar, the TV show that was on the USA Network. And because I don't have cable and I rarely watch TV as it is, I haven't seen him in any of these movies or TV shows, especially TV shows. But if you wish, Final Kill is available on DVD and Blu-ray, or it will be on April 14th, 2020. Words on Film, which is the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am, of course, your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. I've given you the movies that I've seen and my take on them. I've also given you a preview of movies that are coming out on DVD or streaming. And this is usually the part of the show where I tell you the movies that are coming out in theaters this coming weekend or this weekend? Well, I can't exactly do that right now because movie companies like Disney, like Universal, are either delaying their new releases to later dates yet to be determined. Like, for instance, by now, the remake, the live action remake of Mulan should have been in theaters and would have been had it not been for the coronavirus pandemic. It's completely understandable that movie studios are not releasing these movies in theaters or even on streaming. But there are other companies like DreamWorks, which is owned by Universal, that actually are releasing their films on streaming. For instance, the biggest film arguably to be released on streaming this week is Trolls World Tour, which of course is the sequel to the original Trolls film, which came out in 2016, featuring the voices of Anna Kendrick, Justin Timberlake, and many, many others. And several of those characters reprised their role in this animated movie, which I thought was very colorful, very well animated, but kind of a decent film. I wouldn't say it was a great film, and certainly not one of DreamWorks' best, but of course, I loved Anna Kendrick in it. I think any movie with Anna Kendrick is worth seeing, even if she's the voice of a cartoon character. And particularly here, where she had the deserved lead role in the movie, she did well here. But Trolls World Tour brings us Poppy and Branch again. Poppy is the troll voiced by Anna Kendrick, and Branch is the more moody troll voiced by Justin Timberlake, who discover that they are but one of six different troll tribes scattered over six different lands devoted to six different kinds of music. Let me get the full summary here. I just have to click through here. The six different kinds of music: funk, country, techno, classical, pop, and rock. Their world is about to get a lot bigger and a whole lot louder. And a member of the hard rock royalty, Queen Barb, aided by her father, King Thrash, wants to destroy all other kinds of music to let rock reign supreme. And I'm putting my hand in my face right now, making sure I wash it, of course, because why make the hard rock and heavy metal trolls the bad guys here? Come on, that is way too easy. But moving on with the summary. With the fate of the world at stake, Poppy and Branch, along with their friends, set out to visit all the other lands to unify the trolls in harmony against Barb, who looks to upstage them all, literally and figuratively. Let's see some of the other voices in here. I have mentioned Anna Kendrick and Justin Timberlake. The voice of Barb, the heavy metal troll, is actually Rachel Bloom. And Rachel Bloom is not a household name, but she actually is the titular character in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And she's also been in one short film, which is about Ray Bradbury. I can't say the name of the film because I'm on the radio. She's also been, I think she hosted Saturday Night Live one time. She's been a regular on Robot Chicken. So she's certainly had voiceover success here and there, but yeah, she's a new character here. Other actors who are in this film who are voicing characters are actually quite a very impressive roster of actors and singers. George Clinton is one of the voices of one of the trolls, which is awesome. I guess he's the member of the funk tribe. You also have Mary J. Blige as Queen Essence, I guess queen of the pop or R&B tribe. But Kelly Clarkson is the voice of a tribe called Delta Dawn. So obviously there are a lot of very impressive voice actors here. No heavy metal artists or singers in this cast, unfortunately. I would have loved to have heard maybe Gene Simmons or King Diamond be a voice in this cast, but whatever. I don't think this movie is obviously dedicated to or catered to younger children, which is why I'm really kind of mad the heavy metal trolls are the ones that are the bad guys, because come on, that is way too obvious a target. And when your target is the same as concerned housewives in the 50s, that's just not a good sign. I am going to eventually see Trolls World Tour because I see most everything I can. I don't necessarily think I'm going to like it, but because I didn't love the original Trolls film. I thought it was decent. I think kids are going to like it, but it wasn't one that I loved. But I will see this movie and I'll let you know what I think come next week. But I don't actually have Amazon Prime, but I'm seriously considering getting it, especially considering the repertoire of films that Amazon has to stream. They have a ton of films to stream on their platform. I've been seeing either TV series or very old films, and actually, a lot of people have recommended that I give them recommendations for not films that are necessarily new, but ones they can easily access on Netflix. So I figure, hey, you know what? I've got less than 10 minutes on this show. Why not? One film that is streaming on Netflix currently, and watch it while you can, because Netflix has a very peculiar habit of taking films out of their repertoire, particularly those that they didn't make. I don't think they take out any that are originals, but if you want to see a film that you found on Netflix, see it, because you never know when Netflix is going to take it off. And I think that's probably the case with Once Upon a Time in the West. Once Upon a Time in the West is not only a movie I've seen twice, I had the distinct pleasure of seeing this on the big screen, and man, what an awesome movie this is. This is one directed by Sergio Leone, and it's arguably his best Western. It stars so many awesome actors, including Henry Fonda as a stone-cold killer. Yes, Henry Fonda is the villain in this movie, and I think this might be, I could be wrong about this, the only film where Henry Fonda is the villain. But to have him as the villain is really risky. And you have Charles Bronson here in one of his best roles as Henry Fonda's character's vengeful adversary. And there are scenes in Once Upon a Time in the West that are prolific, particularly in the beginning where you're introduced to Charles Bronson and he's playing a harmonica. And that harmonica playing definitely inspired Quentin Tarantino and some of his films, including those that weren't Westerns. This movie is so cool. So if you get the chance to see Once Upon a Time in the West, take it. Sit through the 2.5 hours of this film, brilliantly directed by Sergio Leone, with great acting performances by Henry Fonda, Charles Bronson, and others, and a gorgeous film score by Ennio Morricone, who won an Academy Award for his score in Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight. And I think he's won a couple of Academy Awards before that, but it was definitely deserved for that movie, The Hateful Eight, which unfortunately was a box office bomb. And it's really unfortunate because that film was 3 hours long. I think that kind of fed into Hollywood's theory about people not sitting down for 3 to 4 hours to see a film. If a movie is great enough, not good enough, great enough, they will sit there the whole 3 hours. I think having intermission helps, but honestly, it's just like Roger Ebert said. No great film is long enough, and no bad film is short enough. For instance, Cats might not have been particularly long. I think it was only about an hour and 40 minutes. That movie felt about 3 hours long, especially the very ending with Judi Dench breaking the fourth wall and speaking to the audience. But I'm getting off topic. Another film in the canon, or rather that's available on Netflix right now, a classic one, is Dirty Harry, the first but not the last film where Clint Eastwood plays the hard-boiled San Francisco detective who turns San Francisco into a cop's playground of criminal activity in this nasty classic. And there are two sadists on other sides of the law who duke it out with admittedly very impressive photography here. Clint Eastwood, to me, of course, will always be a legend. Some films in his repertoire, whether he's starred in them or directed them, are hit or miss. But I think it's a testament to Clint Eastwood's acting in the right films where he could take a guy that's completely unlikable, like Dirty Harry, who is bigoted, he's sexist, he's just a bad dude. And not bad necessarily in the good ways, but he could take this guy and have the audience root for him. And really it's kind of spoken or told that he's a bigot, he's racist and sexist, but he's not exactly shown being a crooked cop. But he takes down, I think, the right people in this film. I can't speak for the other films in which Clint Eastwood stars as Dirty Harry, but the original Dirty Harry, it is a fun movie to watch. It is a gritty urban classic, and I recommend you see it if you have the chance. There's another movie that's actually the first film ever directed by Hayao Miyazaki. Hayao Miyazaki being a prolific Japanese animation director. And a lot of people who are big fans of Studio Ghibli, particularly films directed by Hayao Miyazaki, probably have not seen this film, which was Hayao Miyazaki's directorial debut. And this film came out in the late 70s, but you wouldn't know it from seeing it because it is... This movie is lush. And the reason I say, you know, you wouldn't think it was from the late 70s because basically every film company that made animated movies, except for Disney, didn't make them particularly well. But Studio Ghibli, particularly Hayao Miyazaki, is one of the exceptions to that rule. The movie is called Lupin the Third, The Castle of Cagliostro. And this is a Japanese movie about an Italian castle. And this is a film I actually haven't seen. This is actually Lupin the Third is actually a manga character, but he debuted with this character and it really put him on the animation map, which a lot of Western audiences, particularly those in the United States, did not catch on to until probably about 22 years later when he released Spirited Away, which became the first non-American animated film to win Best Animated Feature at the Academy Awards. Granted, Best Animated Feature was a young category. It had only been out for 2 years before Hayao Miyazaki was nominated, but it is a deserved film to have won Best Animated Feature. It's a great original film. Because it's from Japan, it doesn't fall into those stock Hollywood formula movies. So I will definitely see Lupin the Third, The Castle of Cagliostro. I won't exactly recommend it, but I will tell you that it's on Netflix if you want to watch it right now. But the reason I'm not recommending it is because I haven't seen it. I don't know how good it is. I don't know how it compares to other Miyazaki films, but I haven't seen a bad film from Miyazaki, and I don't think this movie's going to be an exception.
Well, that's all the time I have for this episode of Words on Film. I always love talking about movies, and I hope you liked what you heard. If you did, please subscribe and rate the show and leave comments if you can. I would love to get your feedback, even if it's more criticism than praise. This has been Words on Film. I'm Dan Burke, and until my next episode, I'll see you at the movies.